So Rick and Michael will both kind of take it in turns to talk about different aspects of the economic crisis, and then we're going to move over into all-in discussion. So really encourage everyone to write down your own thoughts and comments about what's happening right now in the economy, or jot down any questions that you want to ask Michael and Rick, and hopefully we can get through those. But for now, I will hand it over to Michael, and was just wondering if you could start by talking to us about some of the features of the crisis internationally and some of the underlying economic problems that has preceded it.
Well, thank you, Eleanor, and thank you, everybody, for inviting me to speak. One of the small advantages of this global plague is that we have now found the use of Zoom and other webinars to communicate across the world, so that Socialist Alternative for anybody else doesn't have to pay exorbitant amounts of money to have me to fly over as a guest celebrity guest to your meetings. And then you have to talk to me for days on end until they get rid of me again. Now, the whole thing can be done in just an hour or so over the internet. And we can also participate across the world in these discussions. So that's one big advantage that's come out of the global plague. Unfortunately, there aren't many other advantages that have come from the plague. We can see that, according to the latest figures, we're close to 3 million deaths across the world as a result of COVID-19. There is a massive, hundreds of millions of people now have been infected. And still at this stage, in many countries, particularly in Europe and North America and Latin America, the infections continue at a pretty heavy rate, even if deaths have declined a little bit. In the case of the UK, where I'm talking to you now, we've just come out of the longest lockdown we've had since the COVID started. Just before the Easter break here, we are now able to go outside and talk to up to six people in the garden in our houses. That's the only thing we can do. Only essential shops like food shops are open. All other shops are still closed, and the relaxation is going to take some time, despite the fact that we've now probably got around about 50% of the population vaccinated at least with one dose. And then Europe, the situation is even worse, where lockdowns are being reimposed in various countries. And, of course, in the United States, it's total chaos, with some states applying lockdowns, others not. So if you go to Florida, you can sit next to Rick and Eleanor comfortably with no problem, no mask, no nothing, even though the infections are totally out of control, which gives you the indication of the way some states in America are operating. And, of course, if we go to Latin America, the situation is hugely terrible. In Brazil, particularly, with infections totally out of control, the Trump of Brazil continues to operate in a completely erratic and dangerous manner as president of that country. But as I look at you now, I see that in Australia, at least, you can sit fairly close to each other, in at least Sydney and most places in Australia. And looking at these screens, I can see quite a number of you are able to look at this Zoominar in their T-shirts, which, of course, is not possible for us here in the UK. I'm wearing a cardigan because even though we're heading into the spring, the weather hasn't improved much. But what the plague has shown, what has delivered, and I think that's what I want to talk about in my first bit of the contribution, is an unprecedented level of contraction in the world economy. Production has collapsed in just about every country in the world as a result of the social distancing, the collapse of health systems around the world, and the imposition of lockdowns on manufacturing and service industries in most economies. So I'm going to show you a few graphs and take you through this process of what's happened to the world economy as a result of the pandemic. Here you can see, if you look at this graph, you can see that it tells us that in 2020, just about 93% of all the world's countries, there's 189 countries, 93% of them entered a slump in 2020. And if you look at the, you can see this circle, red circle here, shows you the level of the number of countries as a percentage of all countries that were in a slump in the middle of 2020. That's greater. Here's the Great Recession figure, where you can see it was about 60% of countries entered a recession in the Great Recession of 2008-09. So this is much higher. And it's even higher in terms of the spread of the slump around the world than the 1930s Great Depression, which reached about 83% on this measure. So you can see that this is an unprecedented level, or at least spread, of a contraction in the world economy as a result of the lockdowns around the world, the closure of trade, and so on. But not only that, the collapse in output during the slump was truly tremendous. On the right-hand side of this graph, you can see how much production and output in most economies fell at the depth of the slump about the middle of last year, about this time last year. And you can see that Australia fell by 10% in the middle of 2020, but actually Australia fell less than most in the world. We have in the UK the happy honour of being the worst fall in the whole of Europe and the G7. We fell 20%. The UK economy contracted by 20% during the middle of 2020. Only India had a worse figure in the middle of 2020. And all the other countries, the major advanced countries, have various degrees of decline, the average being around 12%. Now, at the end of 2020, we have into 2021, we have a picture of the whole year, and it's clear that there are virtually no countries that avoided a slump in 2020. The UK finished with 9.9% slump. That is the biggest fall in the UK for national output in 300 years. The US had a fall of around about 4%, and that is the biggest fall in 1 year in national output since 1946. Many other countries had even larger falls in the spectrum. The only countries that avoided a slump in 2020 were China, Vietnam, Cuba, Laos, and that's about it. China, in fact, grew by 2.5% in 2020. Had a big slump, as you can see, in the middle of the year, but by the end of the year had recovered. So China achieved a V-shaped recovery. It went down in the middle of 2020, recovered in the second half of 2020 to end up being slightly above where it was in 2019. But if you look at the left-hand side graph here, you can see what this tells us is that although most countries, this is where they were in the end of 2019, 100, they dropped by something like 4% on average by the middle of 2020. The recovery, according to UNCTAD, this is what they may get back to something like where they were at the end of 2019 by the end of this year, 2021, maybe. Many countries won't achieve that. But you can see that if the growth rate that was being achieved at the end of 2019 had continued without the plague, it would have been by the end of 2021 up here at 106 against 100, up 6% over the 2 years, 2020 and 2021. But actually, this is where we're going to be likely to be. When I say we, I mean the average in the world economy is going to be here. So in effect, this area here is a permanent loss of output in the world. Well, you say, well, okay, so what does that mean? Well, it means that people have lost incomes, they've lost jobs, we've lost investment, we've lost improved, better resources to meet the growing problems around the world. This has been lost forever by the pandemic slump. And there's, at the moment, the trajectory suggests that we will not return to this level of growth rate here. We will continue, and it will go possibly take a very, very long time, even if we do get back to the trajectory before, which is unlikely, but we're going to be permanently having lost this. There's a permanent damage caused by the crisis. Here's the figures of the estimate of the loss between 2020 and 2022 by the IMF, and they show you on the left-hand side that the advanced The economies dropped by about 6% in 2020. The emerging economies, that's the so-called, if you like, global south, dropped by more than that, 7%. And if you exclude China, which was in that red block here, that's even bigger, about 8%. Some of the poorest countries dropped by 6%. In 2021, you can see the advanced economies have still had a per capita income loss of around about 5%. In the current year, we'll have, and so on. You can see that the global south countries will be even worse. 2022, slowly that global loss begins to decline. So whereas if you take the advanced countries, it was 6%, this year it will be reduced to 4%. That's the income loss per person in these areas, and then maybe about 3% by the end of 2022. But the cumulative loss over those years, 2020, 2022, means that permanent loss of about 4.5% in the advanced economies, and in the emerging economies, if you exclude China, something closer to 8%. That's the loss over 2 years that cannot be restored. It's gone forever as a result of the plague. And that 8% for the global south is a disaster for those countries because it means huge increases in unemployment, losses of income, and people forced back into poverty when they might have been escaping otherwise. There is a permanent damage in living standards as a result. The IMF says that this is the worst peacetime contraction since the Great Depression. But because of the partial nature of the rebound, over 150 economies out of 189 are expected to have per capita incomes below their 2019 level by the end of this year, 2021. And that number declines only to 110 economies by the end of 2022. So the cumulative loss of output in the world over the whole period, the IMF estimates, from the beginning of the pandemic in 2020 up until 2025, halfway through this decade, is still 22 trillion compared to where they might have been. So that's the situation which this pandemic slump has created. Not only the depth of the slump, the spread of the slump in 2020, but also the permanent damage and the inability of most economies, virtually all of the economies, capitalist economies, to recover and enter the same levels of growth. And they were low enough as it was, I'll explain in a minute, before the pandemic started. So if you want to look at it like this, I like to look at it like this. Rather than getting a V-shaped recovery, which you see here, taking us back up to this blue line, which is where we were would have been on the previous scenario before the pandemic, we've got what I call a reverse square root. You go down, you come up, but you don't return to this blue line. You run along here, depending on what your forecast is. This one by the OECD has a black line showing you never get quite back there to the end of 2022. So this picture of a reverse square root, which means that whereas you had a growth rate up here on this blue line, now after the pandemic, you have a growth rate down here. This is what happened after the Great Recession too. You had a slump. You didn't return to this previous trajectory. You go on to a slower growth rate for all the economies, so virtually all the economies. So what this shows is that whereas a period of, if you like, I call it a long depression from 2008-09 up until 2019 for 10 years, where the growth rate remained below the previous growth rate. Just to give you an idea, the world economy averaged a growth rate of between 3 and 4%, the whole world, before 2008 when the Great Recession came, from the previous 20 years on average. Advanced countries are lower than that, about 3%. But after the Great Recession, the growth rate in the world dropped to about 3 to 4% or 3%. And in case of advanced countries, it dropped to 2% or below. What this is telling us is that even that growth rate of 2% is unlikely to be restored over the next few years as we go beyond 2021, 2022. We're going to have growth rates around the world. So if we'll take Australia's growth rate, which is better than most in the past, it's going to be, say, 1 percentage point lower as a result of the permanent damage done from the pandemic. And why is this? Well, this is where we get to looking at it from the point of view of Marxist analysis. And the basic way of analysing, in my view, the health of a capitalist economy. And I emphasise the word capitalist economy because a capitalist economy produces and invests and employs people for one thing only, to make profits for the owners of capital and the means of production. Nobody is employed, nobody goes to work under a capitalist economy unless capitalists think it's worthwhile in order to make a profit. They compete against each other to make a profit, and they also employ workers to produce that profit, and that's the basis of the capitalist mode of production. But if the profitability of that investment, whether it's in machines, means of production, and labour, should start to fall, the ratio between the total profits being made and the total investment the capitalists have to make, then there is a crisis that will develop for capitalist economies. They'll slow their investment, or perhaps they'll even close down, and there'll be a ricochet effect across an economy producing a slump. And in fact, what we can show, Marx has a law, I call it the law of falling profitability. To be more exact, it's the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So there's a tendency all the time for the profitability of capital to fall because the profits that capitalists are making out of exploiting workers are not sufficient over a period of time to compensate for the investment in technology and machines necessary to try and increase labour's productivity. There's a tension between the drive to increase productivity of labour by using machinery and labour, intensification of workers, and the fact that there's a tendency for profitability to fall. Does that law hold? Well, this graph attempts to prove that it does hold over a very long period. And this is a view of the global profitability worked out by Esteban Maito in Argentina, using 14 economies. He averaged the rate of profit. Michael Roberts has brilliantly distorted his graph into something he likes the look of. And you can see that from right back to the beginning when Marx wrote Marx's Capital in 1867, or published it, you can see there was a long depression, a decline in the rate of profit. So there was a fall in profit. Then we had a recovery period towards the end of the 20th century. Then we had war, so quite a high rate of profit here during war because of the destruction of capital, the need to restart. Then you get a collapse into the Great Depression of the 1930s, and then war drives the rate of profit back up again. And we enter after the post-war period, a relatively high rate of profit, not as high as it was back here, but still a relatively high rate of profit after the Second World War, which a lot of people call the Golden Age, when there was full employment, welfare state was improved, capitalists could afford to make concessions to workers and the labour movement. Then we enter a period where the rate of profit starts to fall again, what we call a profitability crisis, and it drops down really sharply. This is a period of intense class struggle as workers try to defend the gains they made in the Golden Age and after the Second World War, and the capitalists try to take them away. There is a big class battle because the capitalists can no longer afford these things. This ends basically in the defeat of the labour movement with a series of slumps in the 1980s. Then we get what we call the neoliberal recovery, privatisation, anti-trade union laws, deregulation. All measures tried to drive up the rate of profit at the expense of workers. You can see that it succeeded in a very limited way on a global scale to boost the rate of profit. And finally, not very much. So all that terrible period of 1980s up until 2000 and beyond has not really boosted the capitalist rate of profit on a global scale. And since the beginning of the 21st century, the rate of profit remains at very low levels. And then with the Great Recession of 2008-09, it reached a new low. And we can look a little bit closer across the world to see some differences here. I've taken it from 1950. You can see this is the Golden Age. There was generally a rise in the rate of profit. So the orange line gives you the global figure. The red line gives you the rate of profit in the global south, if you like, the emerging economies. And the blue line gives you the rate of profit in the advanced economies like Australia, United States, Britain, and so on. And you get the same trend. The Golden Age is relatively high. This profitability crisis. Then we have the neoliberal recovery, which is relatively successful, and then we enter what I call the long depression, because the rate of profit continues to decline to levels you can see now in the case of the advanced economies, to lows just before we get to the COVID pandemic. The profitability of capital in the advanced economies is at a post-1945 low. I just wanted to compare the US with Australia for the benefit of you guys over there. And there are some interesting differences, but also similarities. The Australian internal rate of return on capital, this is taken from the Penn World Tables. I won't bother you with that. You can argue about the stats with me later. There's the Golden Age, again, pretty much the same. Then you get the big profitability crisis, same for Australia, same for the US. This is the US, the red line. Then you get the neoliberal recovery, which takes the rate of profit in the US back up, not to the highs of the Golden Age, but back up quite considerably. But in the case of the Australia, lucky country, it goes up really much higher. And this is based primarily, and I'm sure Rick will tell us more about that, on the mining boom, where Australia became a big resource center for fast-growing Asian economies, particularly like China, to export to, and the basis of Australia's ability to boost profitability. But it also entered a decline after the end of the 20th century and into the Great Recession. But there was a mining boom, which I think we could argue ended about the 2014 or so, and we've seen a bit of a slump and then a recovery in the Australian rate of profit. But the Australian rate of profit, relatively higher than the US, although lower than the peaks of the past, means that Australia is a capitalist economy which is a little bit more healthy, if you like, in some extent, than the US. But that's perhaps where I should stop for the moment. I just want to show one other graph, if it's there. Here is just before the pandemic. We have, I like to measure what is happening to global profits in general. Now, this is not the rate of profit. This is the total amount of profits in the six top economies of the world weighted together to give you a global profit figure. So it's a mass of profits, the total amount that are produced on a year-on-year basis. And you can see the long period back to 97, profits rise very much in a high-tech boom. Then we get the dot-com bust. Then the credit boom, profits doing quite nicely. Then we get the Great Recession, profits slump. There's actually a fall in profits, not just a fall in the rate of profit, but a fall in the total amount of profits. And when that happens, when it goes below this blue line, that's when you get slumps, because profits have actually dropped below zero. Recovery, and you can see in advanced capitalist countries, and China's in this as well, the euro debt crisis, a little bit of a mini recession around 2016, just not below briefly. And then just before the virus, we were grinding to a halt. There was no profit being produced compared to the previous year in these countries. It's not mean there's no profit at all. It just means that the profits of the previous year are the same as the current year. So there's been no increase in profits. And that makes it more difficult to invest and expand just before the virus. Now you can see what the virus has done to global profits, dropped it down by 25-30% globally. And then in the latter part of 2020, it's been making a gradual recovery in profits into 2021, no, but still way short of getting back to a year-on-year growth rate at the moment. So that's the situation globally. I'll now hand over to Rick to present his arguments on what's happening in Australia.
Australia had a very mild global financial crisis in the mid-2000s, 2008, 2009, and that was due to prompt government spending, because Kevin Rudd is so brilliant, and more importantly, the extraordinary government policy of having a resource-rich continent whose minerals were being exported to China during the crisis. This is a key factor in explaining why the global financial crisis left Australia relatively unscathed. The next slide shows that there was a slowing rate of growth in Australia in the lead up to the COVID crisis. So the blue line is the absolute rate of growth adjusted for inflation, and the bars are the percentage change. You can see what a phenomenal collapse there was in the growth rate with the COVID crisis. By far the worst since reliable national account statistics have been collected since 1959. In particular, next, Michael, the level of private investment was falling well before the crisis. And the level of private investment is really a kind of a proxy for the rate of profit or for anticipated profit rates. So there was less confidence about the rate of profit. Investment was already slowing before the COVID crisis hit. Now, the COVID crisis, by international standards, has been relatively mild in Australia too, as a result of another brilliant policy, which is the idea that Australia would be an island continent. You've got to hand it to the government. So as a consequence, the onset of the plague was relatively late in Australia. But subsequently, state governments effectively pursued policies of eradication of COVID through border closures, lockdowns, and contact tracing. And these policies prioritised health rather than a policy of minimisation, which is what the federal government was on about, which was intended to prioritise making profits. But in effect, it would have only prioritised making profits in the short term, as we can see from the policies of minimisation, or we don't give a fucking damn, which have been followed in a series of other countries whose growth rates and whose profits have nevertheless fallen. Australia has gone through a V-shaped recession with a fairly sharp recovery currently underway. And that's likely to continue, at least for a while, unless there are new COVID outbreaks that lead to significant shutdowns in Australia. And I think that Michael's right. The current rate of growth, the current level of recovery, which is very rapid, that is likely to slow down, but growth is likely to continue. But sustained recovery in Australia is largely dependent on the state of the world economy. As Shane Wright wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald earlier this month, forgotten is where the economy was before the pandemic. Investment rates were at a then record low. Unemployment was barely shifting down, while underemployment was stuck at a high level, while wages growth was a distant memory for most Australians. Economic victory can't be declared. We are leaving the pandemic recession behind in the dust, but we have to accelerate even faster. Now, where the term we is used, that is not exactly the likes of us or the Australian working class. That is an injunction to government and what the bosses want to see happen. So I'll now hand it back to Michael to deal, hopefully very concisely, Michael, with the most popular explanations offered of the crisis and cures for it.
Well, thanks, Rick. I mean, Rick, it's and everybody, it's almost impossible to do this this is a whole new session or series of sessions to discuss different alternative theories of crises. So I'm going to nip through them the best I can. People can ask questions afterwards, I hope, if they didn't follow me very clearly. So crises under capitalism, let's first say there have been regular and recurring crises. What do we mean? We mean slumps in production, investment, employment and incomes on a regular basis, significant, that damages whole sections of working people's livelihoods and destroys a lot of the businesses which exist before each slump. So these slumps or recessions, as they're called, have been happening about between 8 to 10 years on a regular basis since the Second World War and even before,
And sometimes they're very severe, like a depression that we had in the 1930s, or we had really after the long recession, the Great Recession of 2008. But sometimes they're short and sharp and come back again. But these regular and recurring crises are ignored or denied by mainstream economics. Mainstream economics says that the market economy, that is production for profit, works perfectly harmoniously as long as there's free markets, no interference by governments and trade unions and things. And the only things that cut across it are occasional what they call shocks to the regular growth system. These shocks could be caused by things like plagues, or could be caused by reckless activity by banks, or could be caused by governments intervening to disrupt the market process. So mainstream economics denies that there are crises on the whole. But clearly, that is an argument which just does not hold water, and even mainstream economists recognise that it's not really a convincing argument to say that crises are caused by the occasional shock to the harmonious expansion of the market economy. And in particular, in the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes, when he saw the state of unemployment around the world, particularly in the countries like the US and the UK and Europe, was so large and didn't seem to be going away, he looked for alternative explanation of why these slumps should take place rather than just being shocks. Keynes argued that the reason we get slumps in a capitalist economy is was caused by what he calls a lack of effective demand. So in other words, what is the demand? Where is this effective demand coming from? He meant that capitalists will make investments in order to create jobs and in production and so on, and workers will spend the money they get in consuming food and other things to keep them going. These two things collapse. Capitalists, for some reason, stop investing, so there's no more demand coming from buying machinery and factories. That collapses. And workers don't have any money, so they stop buying things, so there's a collapse in the economy. So, you'd have to say that John Maynard Keynes is absolutely right. What is a slump if it's not the fact that workers can't afford anything so anymore, or they're unemployed, and that capitalists have stopped investing because they're not able to make a return on it? So that clearly is what a slump is, but it doesn't really explain why a slump takes place. Why is there suddenly a lack of effective demand? So the fundamental deficiency in the Keynesian theory is that it doesn't explain why we get these slumps on a regular and recurring basis. A lot of Keynesians say to me when we have this discussion, well, forget about the question of why. What are we going to do about getting out of this slump? We've got to increase government spending. We've got to boost wages, because some of them are on the left, and then we get down to the slump. Let's get out of this depression. Stop worrying about the causes. Well, I don't know about you, but I like to think we should consider things scientifically. If we don't understand why something happens, then very likely it's going to happen again. And that, of course, is the case with slumps under capitalism. Then there's an Austrian monetarist theory, which says, a bit similar to mainstream in a way, but also a bit different.
So I'm just going to ask you maybe another 5 minutes. So we can talk to Rick as well.
Okay, another five sessions then.
just about another 5 minutes.
So I'm going to skip the Austrian monetarists. You can see that basically they think there's too much credit in the economy caused by central banks and governments. And if central banks and governments would get out of the system, then everything would be fine. But what they do is they blast us with a load of credit money, a bit like binge drinking, and then there's a hangover afterwards and a headache, which is the slump. The post-Keynesian thing, which I want to deal with, could have dealt with a bit more seriously, is why is it post-Keynesian? Well, it's saying that after Keynes, actually Keynes, the post-Keynesians say, and they're the biggest force in the left of the labour movement. I want you to understand that in economics. The post-Keynesian people, Mike Mikhalkalesky, who claims to be a Marxist and a Keynesian, or did, these people argue that Keynes is actually a radical, and that Keynes wasn't just saying we need to boost demand. He was saying we need to change the system in a way of socialising investment. And the lack of investment demand, rather than demand in general, is the most important thing. But all these theories, including the alternative Marxist theories underneath, which are connected, under consumption,
That's the most popular theory amongst Marxists for crises. The wages are too low. They can't buy all the goods in an economy. Workers can't. So there's a chronic underconsumption. There's not enough consumption or demand from workers because their wages are too low. That's what causes slumps. Or I would say, well, Engels would say, yes, that's always the case. But why are there slumps sometimes and not slumps another time? That doesn't really explain it. If it was the case that wages were too low, then there'd be permanent crisis. Capitalism wouldn't work. So it's clearly not a sufficient explanation. Overproduction. This is, again, a popular theory. First put forward, perhaps, you might say, by Luxembourg in some forms. David Harvey is the modern exponent of this. We have too much surplus, not enough. It's not that profits are too low. There's too much surplus, and we can't, and capitalists can't get rid of it. And so there's overproduction, which causes eventually a slump. The Marxist view, as expressed in modern terms by Grossman in the 20th century and Matic as well, is that there's really a lack of profitability, which you saw in those early graphs, which regularly leads to a series of crises on a cyclical basis. So those are the fundamental options against the Marxist theory, which is the last one on this chart. The mainstream one, the Keynesian one, the post-Keynesian one, and the various alternative Marxist theories. And as I haven't got any time to develop these arguments anymore, you'll have to take your opportunity as we go.
Okay, so what's the Marxist explanation? The real Marxist explanation, the effective Marxist explanation. And that is something that Michael has already referred to, which is the tendency for the rate of profit to fall. And this locates the cause of recurrent and inevitable crises at the very heart of capitalist production, the way in which capitalism makes things. Other Marxist theories talk about distribution, talk about the allocation of resources. The tendency to rate of profit to fall is about how things are produced. And in particular, capitalism's crisis tendency is intimately connected with its most progressive feature. And the most progressive feature of capitalism is the way it has revolutionised the productivity of human labour. The way in which you want to harvest a wheat crop at the beginning of the 19th century, well, you got out, well, you got your agricultural labours out with a sickle, or maybe a scythe, to harvest it that way. Each worker was not harvesting a very large amount of wheat compared with a worker driving a ginormous combine harvester. Productivity of human labour vastly increased. The amount of human labour, even counting the cost of the combine harvester, going into each kilogram of wheat dramatically lower than it was previously. Okay. Terrific increase in productivity, very progressive. But there's a problem. What is the source of new value in any society? The source of new value is the natural raw materials, but specifically in quantitative terms, it's the amount of human labour that has gone into producing it. And the rate of profit is a measure of the new value created as opposed to the value that's gone into creating a product. And that value that goes into creating a product is the value embodied in the means of production, machinery, equipment, and so on, the combine harvester, and the value of the labour power that has gone into producing the commodity. That is, how much it costs to reproduce a worker so that can come back the next day and do the work. So the rate of profit measures the new value that the worker has created compared with the boss's outlay on wages and on means of production. But if the outlay on means of production is increasing in a consistent way, and the outlays on wages are not increasing at the same rate, and may even be decreasing, this doesn't necessarily mean a wage cut. then the ratio of the new value created by that amount of labour, if we assume that the rate of exploitation remains the same, that is the ratio between the new value that a worker creates compared with the value embodied in their own labour power, then the rate of profit will fall. That is, the mass of profit may increase, but the ratio between that mass of profit and the boss's total outlays will decline. The rate of profit will fall. Now, Marx and Henrik Grossman, whose biography I wrote, talked about a number of counteracting tendencies. So the rate of profit does not fall what statisticians call monotonically. It doesn't just go down. It goes down in a jagged fashion because these counteracting tendencies, some of which include the cheapening of the value of labour power, because the things that workers consume, a kilo of bread, which has the cheaper wheat embodied in it, has gone down. Therefore, the cost of reproducing a worker's labour power has gone down. That can counteract, in part, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Similarly, a cheapening of the cost of means of production. Finding new sources, cheaper sources of raw material, like mountains made out of iron ore in Western Australia. A variety of factors can counteract the tendency of rate of profit to fall. But as Michael showed in his long-term graph from MITAN of the rate of profit, there has been a tendency for it to fall in a jagged fashion. And we have to explain the jaggedness of that decline in the rate of profit by looking concretely at the factors that have increased the ratio of dead labour, means of production, to living labour, that is, human beings' labour power, in the outlays of bosses compared with the actual concrete counteracting tendencies that have come into play. So crises are an inevitable aspect of capitalism and are actually the flip side of capitalism's progressiveness as a mode of production. If we want to get rid of capitalist crises, we have to get rid of capitalism itself. We have got to get rid of the mechanism that drives capital accumulation, which is competition between capitalists. And how do they compete? They compete by investing in additional means of production so they can produce more cheaply than their rivals, and in order to continue to make profits. And because the other capitalists are doing the same thing, that process is an ongoing one. We've got to get rid of that system. And that system is based on the fact that in order for us to survive, we have to sell our ability to work. And there are various people who talk about socialism. They talk about market socialism. Market socialism is another name for capitalism because it's premised on the idea that workers will still sell their ability to work. The stuff that they need in order to survive will still be commodities that require money in order to purchase them. We have to get rid of the commodity system, we have to get rid of the market and replace it by planned production. Now, I'm not going to go into any details. In fact, I'm not going to say any more about how exactly we go about this process. That is a subject for other discussions at this conference. It is not the case, however, that we just have to wait for the revolution. We can fight for better wages and conditions. We can fight for improved welfare, which you can call a social wage, in the here and now. But we should not be under any illusion that this will be good for capitalism. The under-consumptionist argument that there is not, that wages are not high enough, and really that's a flip side of the overproduction argument that Michael also indicated there. That argument is premised on the idea that actually capitalism will be better off if workers are paid more. It's not the case. Workers will be better off, capitalism will be worse off. The crucial thing is to fight for improvements in our lives in the here and now, and to build on the fight, on the class struggle around immediate demands, to look beyond those immediate demands towards a struggle to bring down the system as a whole.